Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities needed by academic leaders among Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox communities for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to CiceronianSociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society, and before we get started, please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I'm grateful to be joined today by three good friends who are no strangers to the Ciceronian Society. I'm going to introduce each of them, and then we'll probably the order that they'll talk. First, we have one of our board members, Ethan Alexander Davey, and co-editor of the volume Under Discussion. Ethan was the first person I ever met from Rhode Island, and he received a BA in Russian and Ancient Greek from Amherst College, after which he spent a year as a Fulbright Fellow in St. Petersburg, Russia. He has an MPhil in Russian Studies from Cambridge University and a PhD in Political Science from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He did a couple postdoc positions before landing at Campbell University in North Carolina, where he teaches courses throughout the history of political thought, constitutional law, and American national government. He is co-editor with Rick Avramenko of Aristocratic Souls and Democratic Times, which is a prequel to the book we're going to discuss today. We also have Michael Harding of Montgomery College in Maryland. Michael was born in New York, but raised in Texas. He holds a BA from the University of North Texas and MA degrees in philosophy and politics from the University of Dallas, and he stayed there to finish his PhD writing on Nietzsche, who we will talk about today. He also just released with our board chair, Bill Batchelder IV, The Philosophy of Philip Reif, a book which he co-edited with Bill. And Ethan and I are both in that book as well, but you know who's not in that book? Luke Sheehan. Luke is assistant professor of political science at Duquesne University and a non-resident scholar at the Program for Research on Religion and Urban Civil Society at the University of Pennsylvania. That's a mouthful, man. His research focuses on First Amendment rights with special focus on the freedom of association, and he's published on academic freedom and Robert Nisbet, among many others. Luke received his bachelor's degree from the Honors College at Oregon State University and his MA and PhD from the Catholic University of America. He and I actually graduated there on the same day. I don't know which one of us went across the stage first. I'm going to say it's me because I have the microphone right now. So definitely I got there first. But Luke is on our advisory board. He's also editor of the University Bookman and author of Why Associations Matter, The Case for First Amendment Pluralism. All right. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
All right. Well, enough of my voice. Let's get to Ethan, the greatest voice in all of the Ciceronian Society history so far. So you co-edited this book with Rick, and it's a prequel to a previous book. And with reference to that earlier volume, Aristocratic Souls, this book, which is titled, I don't think I said the title yet, Aristocratic Voices, Forgotten Arguments About Virtue, Authority, and Inequality, published by Lexington Books. What are you going for here? What are you guys trying to do with this book?
All right. Well, it's an attempt to recover a way of thinking about politics that is probably beyond the pale today. But also, I wanted to mention that the reason there's a second volume, it's pretty straightforward. Two of my friends who are on this podcast, Luke published a review in Humanitas, I think, saying, well, this is an interesting book, but here are some more aristocratic thinkers that should be considered. And then also the first volume had an essay on Nietzsche, which I didn't like very much. And I knew someone who could write a much better essay on Nietzsche. And so that's Michael Harding. So that's the simple reason that there's a second volume. But yeah, let me get into what it's all about. So what I say in the introduction to the first volume is that aristocratic political thought is predicated on human inequality. Of course, there are ways in which human beings are all equal, but there are also ways in which they are unequal. And these inequalities have very important implications for politics. So let me discuss, for a start, three of these implications. So first, since we're the Ciceronian society, how about a quotation from Cicero? And I use this quotation in the first volume, Aristocratic Souls. So toward the end of his dialogue on the laws, Cicero says this: just as the whole state is habitually corrupted by the evil desires and the vices of its prominent men, so it is improved and reformed by continence on their part. So the idea is pretty simple. Ordinary people look up to the prominent members of society, whoever they happen to be, and they try to be like them. So the character of those leading men is extremely important. Now, in the Roman Republic, the senators were at the top of the social hierarchy, and one of the jobs of the censor was to ensure that the senators displayed good moral character, and even to impose penalties on those who didn't. So now let's fast forward to the 21st century. Whom do the mass of ordinary people look up to? Well, it seems like it's the big entertainers, most of all, which is quite a change considering the starting point. In the Roman Republic, entertainers were often slaves, or at least they were not allowed to exercise the rights of citizenship. But now, some of the richest and most influential people in our society are men who dress, talk, and act like gangbangers and scantily clad women. And so it's not surprising that a lot of the youth and even those who are young at heart try to ape those lifestyles. So one lesson of aristocratic political thought is that the character of the most prominent members of society is crucial for the health of society as a whole. It might even be the most critical question for politics. And this is not something that can be left to chance, to freedom of choice, or the whims of the market. Positions of prominence cannot be open to just anyone who can climb to the top. And so we have to be concerned about the education and training of the elite. Go back to Plato, who starts this whole line of thinking in Western political thought in the Republic with his discussion of the selection and education of the guardians. All right, so that was only the first point. I'm going to try to be less long-winded, but second point. These days we hear all the time about the struggle of the people and the elites, the people versus the elites. This is something that aristocratic thinkers discuss very frankly, and in ways that could probably help us understand our present situation better. There are very few aristocratic thinkers I am aware of who advocated a purely aristocratic form of government. Most of them advocated some kind of mixed regime. So I'll point to Cicero again. In On the Republic, the main character of the dialogue, Scipio Africanus, promotes the Roman constitution as a mixture of monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy. And of course, I think everyone's heard that. But the main elements are the aristocratic and the democratic. So aristocratic thinkers view a polity not just as an undifferentiated mass of individuals, but as a collection of different estates or classes, which have different interests and different dispositions, different characters. A mixed constitution is one that represents these different parts of society in different parts of the government. So, for instance, the Senate was where the aristocrats were, and the tribunes of the plebs represented the common people. There were also other democratic assemblies in the Roman constitution. And so when you get the idea is that if when you get the balance right, the government represents the interests of all and curbs the vices and excesses of each part. All right, I'm not being any long-winded, less long-winded, but anyway, the third point. One possible explanation of why Western societies today are unraveling is that we no longer have the powerful classes that used to teach us to value what Russell Kirk called the permanent things. So John Stuart Mill, in his book on representative government, says that in the modern era, European societies are down to two classes, laborers and the employers of labor. So the two powerful social forces are all composed of homines economici, homo economicus, the people who value almost nothing but production and consumption, or value those things primarily. Edmund Burke, okay, our other big figure here. Edmund Burke wrote the following in his Reflections on the Revolution in France. Quote, "Nothing is more certain than that our manners, our civilization, and all the good things which are connected with manners and with civilization have, in this European world of ours, depended for ages upon two principles, and which and were indeed the result of both combined. I mean, the spirit of a gentleman and the spirit of religion, the nobility and the clergy." And then later in that same paragraph, he notes how the revolutionaries in France sought to destroy the nobility and the clergy. What would be the consequence of that? He continues, "Along with its natural protectors and guardians, learning will be cast into the mire and trodden down under the hoofs of the swinish multitude." All right, that's a phrase that's not going to win you too many plaudits today. But anyway, to tear down the guardians of religion and culture, and everyone will sink into the mire of ignorance and baseness. So I think there's a case to be made that a society whose main dispositions or humors are bourgeois and proletarian is not a complete society. So to take the old analogy of the body politic, it's like a body that's missing a couple limbs, or maybe even missing its heart or its head, which makes it a bit of a monster. So we need these other elements that used to have a lot more power and influence to orient the public toward the permanent things. These elements are some equivalent of them. Right, so that's a few thoughts on what aristocratic thought is about and what it might have to say to us in the present.
Great. That's a great summary, and I appreciate that. It made me think of I used to teach when I was a professor, I taught a class on imagination and politics, and I would start the class by saying something to this effect, like if you knew that as a parent your kid was going to lead public opinion or be a president or be a member of the Senate, how would you want to form them and develop them? Right. If they were, I didn't use this word, and I should have looking back now, if they were going to be an authority, right? I wouldn't have said the word aristocrat. I want to come back to that word in a minute. But, what would you have them read? Right. What would you have them do to prepare for that? And both that, when I was at the two different schools where I taught that class at, the students hated the question. They hated the question because the idea that they're, like, I just want my kid to be like everybody else. Like, that's what they would say. I don't want them to lead, in a sense. I just want them to be, well, they didn't use that phrase, but essentially, the idea of being better, right, is just so gross to modern ears and to our students. And because it violates some kind of inner, that we have to be equal in some ways, in this sense. And aristocratic political thought is kind of going against that trend, because there's in inequality of some kind is inevitable, right? That's a big piece of this. So I'm wondering, though, and kind of coming off what I was just saying, and there's so many really interesting thinkers that are covered in this book that we're not going to talk about, Vico, Newman, Thomas Eliot with a Y, which I've never even heard of him. Let's see, who else is in here? Cusa, I know, is in there, right? Plutarch, I've heard of him. and Oswald Spengler, Julius Evola, is that how you say his name? Evola? Yeah, just some really interesting figures. But the three of you bring some other options to this table that I think will help flesh out what we're trying to get at. So essentially, this animus toward aristocratic political thought, or whatever an aristocrat is part of what we're doing. So I'd like to actually go to Luke first on this. Luke's chapter deals with Robert Nisbet and how he looks at this problem. So given what Ethan just said about aristocratic political thought, how does Robert Nisbet diagnose the problem of authority in the modern world? And because I think this is going to give a lot of weight to why what Ethan and Rick tried to do with this book and the previous one are so important.
Yeah, so Robert Nisbet is was a sociologist, one of the most prominent sociologists of the 20th century. President Reagan gave him the Jefferson, he gave the Jefferson Lecture, which is the highest award given by the federal government in 1987. So a very prominent figure. His kind of highest academic post was at Columbia University. He held the Albert Schweitzer chair there. So a major figure in academia. And in fact, he's one of the rare conservative intellectuals of the 20th century that actually spent his entire career in academia. Most of them, you know, Rester Kirk and others left or were kicked out at some point. Robert Nisbet alone, I think, spent his entire career there, which is interesting because he makes a big part of his study was on the importance of authority. You know, he starts writing in the 1950s. His first and most famous book is The Quest for Community, published in 1953, a fateful year. For the broader conservative movement, and he published this book. It was published with Oxford University Press, so you know, mainstream academic book. And he makes the argument there that the rise in the authority of the modern state over the last several centuries depleted social authority. So it crushed the aristocracy, crushed the authority of local communities, townships, that sort of thing, crushed the church or churches. So all of these social institutions lost their authority. And this has kind of reached, he sees it as reaching a real crisis point in the 20th century. And he's writing, remember, this is 1953. And he writes in the book of all of these institutions have collapsed in the 19th century or they're in steep decline, including, he says, the family. So 1953, he says, the family's on its way out. There's no way that you can take away the function and authority of an institution and expect it to survive. So the next, you know, two decades would just prove his point. So I think writing 1953, we look back on that as like the heyday of the family. And he saw that all of its authority and function had been taken away. The state educates children. The family doesn't do it. The state provides for the family in many ways. And so what exactly is it that the family does, other than the kind of very bare act of producing an individual and then kind of fostering them for a couple of years, but anymore, you know, state subsidizes daycare. And he recognizes this. And his reasoning for it is, you know, why do these institutions collapse? Is because they've been have their authority taken away by the centralized political state. And he says, you know, the social bonds, what bonds us to other human beings psychologically and functionally, is the exercise of authority. So I think he's really starts to emphasize the term hierarchy as he gets into the 1960s and 1970s in his work there. And I think what he's responding to is the new left. So the new left was saying, you know, we've got to have consensus and we've got to have participatory democracy and every institution has to be like this. So we all are just equals and we kind of make decisions together. And then, you know, we'll be in these nice little communes together and these sorts of things. And Nisbet said, that's not how it works. Hierarchy is how it works. And you look around you and you see every possible institution. And what is it? It's a hierarchy. You look in a classroom, there's a teacher and a student. You look at universities and there's presidents and provosts and deans and full professors and assistant professors and lecturers. Everywhere you look, if there's an institution that's operating, including the Ciceronian Society, there's a board of directors, there's an executive director. These are all hierarchy. It does not work, even at the very simplest level, without clear hierarchy. And he said, he writes in The Social Philosophers, he says, hierarchy is not an inevitable outcome. I mean, it is an inevitable outcome. It's also a good. It's good to have hierarchy. It's the only way anything gets done. And it's important to recognize certain values is more important than other values. You have to recognize that if you have any moral system at all. So his emphasis is that authority is absolutely essential to any meaningful community. So we're not going to have the social bonds in any type of society without authority and hierarchy.
Yeah. And so he's in many ways, again, like, so Ethan is by putting together these, you know, looking at these different voices, he's saying, like, we've forgotten these people that have spoken to what authority looks like and what it should be. Nisbet being one of the latest of the entire book. I think he is the latest in the book in terms of timeline. One of the things that strikes me, though, I guess I could come back to this and say, well, Nisbet, what's wrong with the state? I mean, this is not my view, right? But what's wrong with the state being in this in Mike, feel free to jump in here. The state has hierarchy, right? The state is an authority. We have this, I mean, bureaucracy, right? As we, you know, we teach, I mean, that's all hierarchy, right? Maybe, you know, this, you know, and again, none of your thinkers are trying to say, let's go back to the Middle Ages, where these were, a certain way, you know, but why not just accept that maybe the aristocracy is the bureaucracy. The aristocracy is the people we elect. You know, because one of the themes in the book, at least in some of these chapters, is that's not the case, right? Why not advocate for, you know, is the state basically just the embodiment of the aristocracy we supposedly lost? I guess, Luke, why don't you start by responding to that, and then the Michael and Ethan, you guys can jump in.
Yeah. So the state, from Nisbet's view, took the authority, absorbed the authority of these other institutions. Yeah, so the one question is, well, who cares? And then it just exercises that authority and everything works out. But that's not true for Nisbet. So Nisbet sees the state's absorption of that authority, the centralization of that authority, simultaneous with that centralization of authority, is the atomization of the populace. So the problem with it is we don't end up in, well, you know, we were in these communities, maybe there was the local aristocrat, and then there was your local parish and your local guild, and you had, those were communities, the state's absorbed all of those functions, but that's okay. They're just exercised elsewhere. But that's not what happens. What happens is the people are then individualized and atomized, and you end up with alienation. So when you're attending your local parish with your local priest, and your local aristocrat pays for the roof and pays the salary of the priest, and then shows up and sits in the back row and kneels right next to you, because that's what you do when you're the aristocrat, you set the example. That's a very different interaction than having none of those things. And the bureaucrat shows up, tells you what to do, and then leaves. This is entirely different. When you're have those local authorities, you feel psychologically connected to them. If they have a functional authoritative role in your life, when it's the exercise of power, it's the bureaucrat who sends you the letter and tells you what to do, or shows up and inspects your property and finds you and walks off. Like that, this is entirely a different relationship. It's the relationship Nisbet calls it, the difference between power and authority, the exercise of the state's power, its coercive power, and the exercise of authority. And one incorporates you into the social bond, the other one alienates you from it. And so you end up with a widespread sense of a loss of community. And so that creates all sorts of problems, including, for example, rises in suicide rates and deaths of despair, which is exactly the trend that we saw. Nisbet predicts it, basically, using Emile Durkheim was talking about this in the late 19th and early 20th century. Nisbet draws from him a lot and says, kind of, this is what's going to increase and increasingly come. It's exactly what plays out over the next few decades.
And that's a really great segue into what Michael's writing about with Nietzsche, because Nietzsche, right, he describes the state, right, as the coldest of all cold monsters, right? Is that, yeah, his phrase?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a wonderful phrase. And I do tend to think that section of Zarathustra is quite often misread. So I guess in relation to this, to the broader discussion we're having, the collapse of these social institutions, the loss of authority, for Nietzsche, that's not a, how do I want to put this? That doesn't originate in recent time. There's deeper causes. And the problem is what he calls the crisis, you know, he calls this nihilism. And nihilism means, according to Nietzsche, that the question why no longer finds an answer. I always think of Richard Rorty on Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity, sitting there in his garden with he's got a glass of lemonade or something. God is dead. Everything is fine. And this is really what Nietzsche is motivated by. Right? So the way we conceive of the nature of the whole determines the way we conceive of these more human concerns about society. And there's this wonderful passage in the second Untimely Meditation, Nietzsche's Use and Disadvantage of History for Life, where he's talking about the impact of Hegel. Some of my friends who are, let's call them right Hegelians, are going to be very upset with what I'm about to say. That's okay. But the way he describes it, he says, first he makes the comment that Hegelianism is a kind of decayed Christian eschatology. And what he means by this is that the Hegelian understanding of reason and history is a replacement for God. The Hegelian understanding of the state is a replacement for Christ. Christ understood as mediating between sinful man and reconciling sinful man to God gets replaced by the state, which mediates between subjective individual will and the objective will of reason and history. So Hegel says that the state is the divine idea as it exists on earth, which I think takes you directly to the line in Zarathustra where the state says, "The ordering finger of God am I." I mean, that is a very pithy summary, I think, of what Hegel is essentially claiming. The state is the embodiment of the divine logos on earth. So this is part of the problem, right? The state kind of takes on this understanding. But the other problem with Hegel, as Nietzsche sees it and puts it in the Use and Disadvantage of History for Life, is the historicizing doctrines. So the way he phrases it, he says, if the doctrines of sovereign becoming, there are no permanent beings, the fluidity of all concepts, types, and kinds, there is some, in some sense, a kind of epistemological relativism, we might say, and the lack of any cardinal difference between man and the animal, which one of my old teachers called the true Darwinian point. If that is thrown at human beings for a few more generations, he says, it shouldn't surprise us if these older institutions get replaced with what I believe he refers to as, and forgive me butchering the exact language here, what he refers to as systems of individual egoism that are going to kind of run rampant. So you're going to see a social decay as a result of what we might call the change in our metaphysics. I think you see this represented very well in architecture. You think about something like Weigel's book from 15, 20 years ago, The Cube and the Cathedral. The way we conceive of the cosmos and our place in the cosmos is reflected in all of these other things that we don't necessarily think about, right? The society that builds the cathedral is not the society that builds, the brutalist FBI building in downtown DC. That represents a very different conception of the human being and the place of the human being in the world. So the collapse of authority is for Nietzsche the inevitable result of the collapse of our metaphysical understanding. When he says God is dead, he doesn't mean obviously that God was alive and then got sick and died. He means that the belief in a transcendent order, an eternal and unchanging order, whether it's the God of revealed religion and ontotheology, whether it's nature understood in an Aristotelian sense, or even natural law understood in a Lockean sense, he means that none of this works anymore. It doesn't persuade us. It doesn't give meaning to our lives. So the crisis that we're facing today, Nietzsche would say, is the inevitable result of nihilism. As I said a moment ago, the question why no longer has an answer. Why shouldn't I just go pursue my lowest passions? Nothing matters. And if God is dead, everything is permitted. The great danger of the last man, of course, is that the last man, having really rejected all standards, is going to essentially breed the possibility of human greatness out of us. And that's maybe the other key point for Nietzsche in comparison to some of the other thinkers that are discussed in the book. For Nietzsche, the soul is merely a product of the body. The soul, what we call the soul, is the product of these biological drives and their arrangement. So even the individual will, he refers to as being a treaty draft or a temporary arrangement of the different drives. All of the drives in us want at every moment to be the tyrant. You think about the account of the philosopher in Plato's Republic, and you can get a sense of what he means. Every drive wants to be the drive that dominates you. So what Nietzsche wants to say then is that the great danger we face today as a result of the collapse of these institutions, it's not it's not a temporary danger. It's not, oh, eventually, you know, what can't go on won't go on, and human nature will reassert itself and we'll have the possibility of great human beings again. Because Nietzsche is a materialist, the cultural decline and the biological decline are not really going to be separable. So what this means then is that we could think about values, we can think about culture as in a way adaptive, but there's a reciprocal relationship. The way we conceive of the world shapes our values, but also our biological conditions are going to kind of shape the way we conceive of the world. So the common view is that Nietzsche is a relativist, but it's probably better to say not that he's a moral relativist, but that he's a moral pluralist. Because his claim is that because human beings biologically have different natures, there's going to be necessarily different sets of values that are conducive to the flourishing of the human being. So not in the vulgar sense of what's right for me and what's right for you might be two different things, but rather that because we are different organisms, conditions that are of benefit and value to you might not be beneficial and valuable to me. The goal of the organism is to maximize power and to be able to expend that power. So what is conducive to my flourishing and what is conducive to someone else's flourishing might be two very different things. You know, I'm a nerd who wants to talk about philosophy all the time. What is conducive to my flourishing is very different from what is conducive to the flourishing of some of my friends. Yeah, I've got an old friend from high school whose desire in life was simply to build furniture, and that's what he does for a living. What was conducive to him doing that was a very different way of life and a very different set of values than the values that are conducive to me doing what I do. And I guess maybe the other thing to add here is that when we talk about values in Nietzsche, we kind of reduce that to moral values, but he has something much broader in mind. Values, he says, are adaptations to the external world conducive to the preservation and enhancement of an organism. But he doesn't just mean moral values. He means things like epistemological values. What qualifies as knowledge? The way that I conceive of the world is going to be different from the way someone else conceives of the world. And it's going to hopefully be conducive to what is good for me as an organism. So there's a kind of epistemological pluralism here as well. So for Nietzsche, values, it goes beyond just moral values and social values. We can say that Aristotle in the Physics is a legislator of values. Aristotle in his biological works is a legislator of values, and that he's laying down some of the principles that are going to govern these sciences for us. And the problem we face today is that we've lost any kind of ability to recognize higher and lower. And this is one of those difficulties I think that Nietzsche faces. Nietzsche very much wants to ground a recognition of the noble in nature, but he can't accept the understanding of nature that would lead to this grounding of a recognition of the noble. We see the same thing in Rousseau. Rousseau wants to recover a classical understanding of the citizen, but he can't accept the classical physics and the classical psychology. Same thing with Nietzsche. He wants to find a way to recover that, but he can't. So something like the eternal recurrence is meant to function the way religion functioned as a legislator or shaper of values, and in turn, as a way of beautifying the human race. There's this discussion of religion and beyond good and evil, and he makes the point that religion is the greatest tool ever yet developed for the beautification of the human being. Part of the problem we have today is that we are in this kind of this liminal state for Nietzsche between the collapse of the old order, which gave meaning and purpose to human life, and the rising of a new order that's going to do the same thing. Because for Nietzsche, there can be no permanent order, right? The classical order collapses when the pre-Socratics, or the Olympian order, the pre-Socratics chase the Olympian gods out of nature. That brings about a crisis for the Greeks. Then we get Christian Platonism for Nietzsche, which solves the crisis over the long term, deepens the spirit. It makes us stronger in terms of Geist, in terms of intellect and spirit. But as a result of modern philosophy, especially Hegel, Nietzsche sees that order collapsing, and we are in a kind of point of crisis. So everything we're talking about with this collapse of an aristocratic order, that is all symptomatic of this deeper metaphysical and epistemological crisis. We don't see a justification for making distinctions between higher and lower, between better and worse anymore, precisely because of the collapse of this this metaphysical, theological, onto-theological order.
Yeah, and I think it's also, I mean, Nietzsche is so interesting, especially when you talk about him, frankly, because I've said this before, if everything I believed about Christianity was false, Nietzsche would be the most compelling alternative. I mean, to me, he understands the world in kind of this, it's dark. It's not a place I want to go. I don't want to follow him there because it sucks. But in some ways, I think he understands better than most what the implication of a dead God would be. Luckily, God is not dead.
And he's terrified by it.
Yeah, he's terrified by it.
That,
yeah,
that's the thing that so many people miss out on when, you know, when he announces God is dead, he kind of recognizes, well, this might be good for philosophers because it means there is no limit to questions anymore. Right. For the lover of knowledge, this might be great. For the rest of humanity, it's going to be terrible.
Right, right.
So his atheism is a tragic atheism rather than a joyful or triumphant atheism.
Yeah, he doesn't see it. It's not freeing, right? I want to go back to Ethan. So Ethan, you've laid the groundwork for this whole project, and you know, one of the things that strikes me here is that, and you can speak to this before you get into the figure that you read, the use of the word aristocrat is always going to be, I think, especially here in 2025, problematic, because when I hear aristocrat, I immediately think of the people that got their heads cut off in the French Revolution. Like, that's when I, you know, so someone in obnoxious clothes wearing a wig, who doesn't deserve the position they're in, right? To me, an aristocrat, and this is the modern thinking here, is that the aristocrat is exactly the type of person we don't like, right? Someone who has just undeserved power, authority, whatever you want to call it. Which, of course, that's a product of the late 18th century. You know, I'm very American in what I'm saying right now, right? But and Luke brings this up in his chapter. I mean, there's going to be an authority. We don't call them aristocrats, but we basically give them the same. They're aristocrats by some other name. You know, for Tocqueville, it's something like the lawyers, right? Become something of this. But anyways, I want to go back to, choosing that word aristocrat, I'm sure has been, you're comfortable with it, but you know that your audience isn't. And then also, the way that you deal with this question of aristocracy in this particular volume is with someone that none of our readers, our listeners have heard of, Wilhelm Heinrich Riehl. You're the only human being I've ever met who's ever even mentioned his name, which to me means I should read him. If Ethan reads him, I should read him. So I guess respond to that, the use of the word aristocrat, and then how do you use Riehl to kind of diagnose, this collapse of aristocracy?
Yeah, that's a great point. So I guess I would say about the term aristocrat, of course, it has only negative connotations today, but the founding fathers of this country were comfortable using that word. So look at the, you can pick up the letters of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, where they discuss the natural aristocracy. Those are some of the most interesting things that they ever wrote, as far as I'm concerned. And the discussion among the founders on this topic, I think, is very revealing in a lot of ways. But I guess I would go back to Aristotle and say that these terms, they define something, but they also contain within themselves a critique for those who don't live up to the standard. So Aristotle said that there were three forms of government, and then there were three imperfect forms. So aristocracy meant rule by the best. And so to be an aristocrat, you have to actually be the best. You have to actually be excellent. And if you're not, then what we call you is an oligarch. And that is a term that also has been coming back lately. They used to talk only about Russian oligarchs, but now apparently there are American oligarchs too. And I think it's probably good to bring those that term back as well, because there is a form of it that is has many negative qualities, regardless of the connotation. So maybe we should talk about the term oligarchy should have been in the title too, because we don't want oligarchy. Oligarchy is ruled by an elite, but an elite that is mostly concerned with money and its own interests. And that might be a good term for the people who govern us today, perhaps. I think that the terms are important, but we have to be aware that the term also contains within itself a basis for judging the people who might be called that. And so if you're an aristocrat, you actually have to have excellence and to seek what is good for the state and for the people, and not simply hold power and use that power for your own benefit. That was the classical definition that Aristotle gave. Now, as to Wilhelm Heinrich Riehl. Yes, and as we were saying before we started, I can say as much as I like about him now, but still no one will ever know who he is, regardless of how much I say or what I say about him. Let me go back to your previous question and to Nietzsche's cold monster, or Hegel's cold monster, the state. So the problem from the point of view of someone like Riehl. Okay, I should probably say who he was. 19th century German folklorist. He's mainly known for wandering around Germany and visiting various peasant communities and learning about them and writing down their different customs and even their art and literature, such as they had. And so that's what he's mainly known for, to the extent that he's known at all. But out of this, out of his rambling all over Germany, he developed some social theories. And his main objection to the idea that the modern state and the modern bureaucracy should become the new aristocracy or the new rulers is that when you have a modern state and a modern bureaucracy, that authority, that influence, tries to shape the entire country toward one particular model. And that is the mobile individual, who has no ties to any place, who pursues his economic interest, wherever that might lead him. And if the state is oriented toward the protection and advancement of that type, then that's going to dissolve all of the other good things that society has to provide for us. So this gets back to some of the things that Luke said about Nisbet. It's important for there to be authority in different places, not just in one place, but to have authority in different regions, to have authority in different social classes. What you get out of that is, well, first of all, there will be more of a connection, as Luke said, between the authorities and the people they have authority over, because it's more localized. But also, these different sorts of authorities have different dispositions, different priorities. So Riehl says you could divide society, the society he knew, Germany of the 19th century, into four different classes. So you have the nobility, the peasantry, the bourgeoisie, and the proletariat, or the working class. And some of these forces you could call forces of motion. These are classes that seek to move, seek to change things, are oriented toward change and have a kind of dynamism to them. So think of the businessman, someone who, the innovator, right? But there are also forces of continuity, and that would be the peasantry and the nobility. So these are classes that are oriented toward different things. They're more connected to a particular place. Both a peasant, or at least an old-fashioned peasant, lives in the same place generation after generation and develops ties to that community, traditions that are specific to that community. And it's the same with an aristocrat. What he says is an aristocrat is basically a glorified peasant, a much more powerful, a much more prominent person who is more refined in various ways, but is still like a peasant in that he is rooted to a particular place and thinks about his ancestors and thinks what his ancestors would have done before he acts in the present day. And so what to the extent that Riehl has a solution, I mean, none of the writers I write about have solutions that seem palatable today, but to the extent that he has a prescription, it's that, yes, we will continue to have these dynamic classes, but all of the power and influence should not be in the dynamic classes. The more stable or traditional classes need to have power and influence as well. And so as the forces of motion pursue their dynamism, their innovation, they should take a page from the more traditional classes when it comes to family structure, when it comes to showing some respect for different places and their different customs, and also with regard to culture. So the culture that, and one thing he shows, I think, is that the culture that arises from an aristocracy and a peasantry is much more, much better than the culture that comes from a mass society, the culture that is produced by a commercial elite that is trying to, say, sell songs that will sell the greatest number of records, but by appealing to the lowest common denominator. So Riehl's solution or prescription is that the more traditional classes in society need to have more weight. And there are various ways you might do that. He suggests, for instance, that you rig the electoral system to give more weight to those classes. And also he suggests, interestingly, that only married men should be able to vote. So the one estate that is the basis for all the other estates is the family, from his point of view. So you start with the family as the most basic unit of society, and legislation should be designed to protect the family unit. That's the most important thing, because all of the other estates are based on that unit.
So only married men voting. That one, yeah, that one will definitely go over real well. We're gonna go with that right now. Just kidding, man. It one thing that strikes me here is, and I while you were talking, I decided to look this up in the book, see if it showed up in the index. But, and admittedly, I have not read every chapter in the book. But one of the things I think is an important piece, I don't know where this would fit here, that the lack of people that we could point to be, that we would say, you know, if aristocrats are going to come back, in a sense, if we're going to be ruled by aristocrats rather than oligarchs, which I think, by the way, I think it's a really important insight you said, you know, maybe oligarchy should have been in the title, because understanding aristocracy as opposed to oligarchy, I think, is one of the most important pieces of this. Because this comes up in Luke's discussion with Nisbet. You know, Nisbet's saying, look, you're going to have authority even when you're in rebellion against authority, and practically especially when you're in rebellion against authority, you're part of a hierarchy or some, you know, you're following someone, right? And it's probably not the people you should be following. Irving Babbitt gets into this too as well in Federici's chapter. But what strikes me as interesting about all this is that there's a deep lack of courage in our time. That particular virtue, by the way, I think is a key here. The oligarchs, I don't know if we call them courageous, but they don't mess around. Like they do take power when they want it. They pay for it, right? Or they manipulate their way there. And so I'm struck by this need that, you know, if we're going to see the kind of people that Riehl and Nisbet, and heck, even Nietzsche might have celebrated, right? Would they have the courage to do so? Because right now, I mean, if there's one thing that has characterized the last 20 years of global politics, it is the extraordinary lack of good leadership. It's not just an American problem. It is very clearly a European problem. And same thing in South America. I mean, I think it's just around the world, you either have the people that just dominate because they have the most money or they just get the most attention, or they, you know, or whatever. You know, there are, where are the Washingtons of the world, right? The George Washingtons of the world, the greatest American aristocrat, in my view. Yeah, Ethan.
So it's funny that you should mention Washington. I have on my desk somewhere here Washington's rules for civility, and my desk is such a mess I can't pull it up, but you can Google it. Wow. Washington's rules for civility. And so America also had aristocrats or people who had no legal or noble status under law, but who saw themselves as fulfilling that role. And there's another interesting chapter in the book on Sir Thomas Eliot, which one of the books that he wrote is called the Book of the Governor. And this is one of the what were called courtesy books that were published for several centuries. And these were books to teach powerful people how to behave, basically. And so if you wanted to rebuild, you don't have to use the word aristocrats or aristocracy, but rebuild some kind of ruling class, there's so much literature out there that such people could study to learn how they're supposed to behave, what sorts of virtues they're supposed to develop, habits, and how they ought to exercise power. So there's plenty of literature out there for those who would like to learn how to do that. But you're, of course, absolutely right. This would require a lot of courage and willingness to sacrifice a present economic benefit in order to pursue such a project. And now the other thing I'd say is that going back, the French Revolution has been mentioned a few times. The people that replaced the French aristocrats by that point were pretty awful, and the people who replaced them, of course, were even worse, much worse. But as to how does an existing elite get replaced, I think it typically gets replaced when the feeling of contempt for the present ruling class reaches a certain point that people are willing to sacrifice their individual economic position in order to pursue something, to pursue some kind of change of the elites. And of course, I would hope to avoid in any circumstances a regime change like the one that happened in France. I think we all would. But it's also possible for that to be a more gradual process by which the old elite, as it loses its authority, as it loses the respect of the people, a new elite arises in the wings, and by the time the old elite is about to fall, the new one can step in. So that's maybe one possibility for us, is to begin to think about what qualities a new elite should have, and to work on building that.
Well, clearly the answer is to join the Ciceronian society and become join the group of glorified peasants. That's basically
glorified peasants. Exactly.
This is an audio only podcast. So speaking of a glorified peasant, I'm wearing a shirt with a deer antlers on it. So like that's, I am a sophisticated redneck. But that's what we're going for now. But this literature you're talking about, Ethan, this literature to relearn what it means to be and that aristocratic soul, right, is not going to be accepted by the folks that Nietzsche calls tarantulas. And I, that was such a great term in your chapter, Michael. I'd love you to speak to that, because the tarantulas are not going to read this. Like, they would burn this book, is if I understand what you were saying.
Yeah. So the tarantulas in Zarathustra are, I'm trying to think of a delicate way to put this.
Delicate's less fun.
Yeah, and it's not really suitable for Nietzsche.
Exactly.
The tarantulas are those who preach equality out of a desire for revenge. So the tarantula wants everyone to be equal, in the sense that the tarantula wants everyone to be low. The tarantula is, let's say, committed to a kind of violence against human difference. So it's one way to think about this. For all of the talk we give today about diversity, the tarantula ultimately opposes diversity. The tarantula aims at homogeneity rather than diversity, because a true diversity is going to necessarily entail an accepting of some kind of inequalities. This is tied to Zarathustra's pity. The thing that Zarathustra has to overcome during his convalescence, more than anything else, before he can will the eternal recurrence, is the understanding that willing the eternal recurrence doesn't just mean willing the return of all that is high and noble and beautiful. It means willing the return of all that is low and botched and suffers. And that's a hard thing to do. You know, every human being suffers in life, some of us more and some of us less. And on an individual level, you know, it's a difficult thing to be able to look back at all the bad things that happened to you in your life, all the things that you have to endure and suffer, and say, you know what, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't change anything. Not a lot of people can do that. And it's even harder for a figure like Zarathustra to do that, because he's not just willing the eternal return of his own sufferings, of the, you know, that which leads him to take his ashes to the mountains. He's got to will the eternal return of all the suffering in humanity. And the tarantula, you know, the tarantula offers a kind of easy solution. You know, we drag everyone down into what he calls our lie hole lairs. We're going to drag everyone down, make everyone the same, right? The way it's described in the speech on The Last Man, everyone wants the same, everyone is the same. And whoever thinks differently voluntarily goes to the madhouse. So, yeah. I mean, that's what the tarantulas are. The tarantulas are the ones who want to drag us all down to last manhood, a kind of stunning and universal mediocrity. Whereas for Zarathustra, to will the eternal recurrence is to will the return of the high and the low and the mediocre. And that's the challenge, right? It's easy to say, I want the heights of humanity to reoccur over and over and over again, right? I want Michelangelo. I want Da Vinci. I want Mozart. It's a lot harder to say, I want Two Live Crew to return over and over and over again. How can you will the recurrence of all? So Zarathustra, and Nietzsche more generally, I would say, achieves a kind of aristocratic consciousness in the recognition that you have to will. The willing of the eternal recurrence is a willing of the return of difference. You can't just will the high. And for Nietzsche's Zarathustra, justice entails letting beings be what they are. There's something very classical about this. You think about someone like Epictetus, right? There's a point where Epictetus comments about being upset that a slave boy broke a jar. And he says, well, what do you expect, right? He says it's a slave boy. He's going to break a jar. You're upset that someone died. What do you expect? People die. That's what they do. And that's what Zarathustra has to come to terms with, that you don't just will the high, the noble, and the beautiful. You have to will the low and the base and the vulgar. And even more difficult, not just will that it returns, you have to kind of desire that it return. You have to come to accept the low and the vulgar for what they are. Just like you're not going to have a universal aristocracy, you're not going to have, we hope, a universal mediocrity or a universal mass of the vulgar. You're always going to have that kind of diversity, but willing that diversity, the diversity of human types and the diversity of human talents, the diversity of human souls, that's a really hard thing. For the egalitarian that has been bitten by the tarantula. And that's what Zarathustra struggles to overcome. And I think that's what a lot of us would have to struggle to overcome too, if we were trying to will the eternal return. Because willing the eternal return means willing the eternal return, not just of the things we love, but of the things that vex us and the things that break our hearts and the things we hate.
Well, and I think that's also why I think Christianity offers a better alternative, right? In the sense that it's saying it's not our will that brings it back anyway. I mean, there's a will toward the redeemed of humanity, the redeemed reality. And I think that's what Nietzsche misses. I mean, I think he cannot see. I mean, again, if God is dead, there is no one or nothing to redeem us from that. But I want to, that's a different conversation. This notion of diversity and difference, I think is really important here because, you know, Nisbet, going back to Nisbet, you know, he's living at a time where, you know, the emergence of the new left is basically saying that it's the thing that has been the threat to our difference and our diversity and our individuality has been tradition, has been religion, has been these associations. And we're living in that moment still, right? I mean, there's all this anti-family, anti-association period, right? I'm going to define myself as an individual, this morally, physically, existentially autonomous individual. And Nisbet sees this early on, right? I mean, he's seeing that like the direction you're going is going to do the opposite of exactly what you want, right? And is that, I mean, is that kind of an accurate way to say it? I mean, Nisbet's comfortable with difference, and he sees the recovery of these civic associations as them as an answer to that, as a much better way forward.
So he thinks, the rise of these civic associations. I mean, Tocqueville, you know, talks about has that great line where he says, you know, where in England you see something happens in England, it's an aristocrat; in France, it's the government; and but in America, it's an association. So, Nisbet, like Tocqueville, saw these associations as, you know, you're going to have something like an aristocracy. That role is going to be filled somehow. It could be by an oligarchy. That's bad when that happens. Or it could be by the state. That's also bad when that happens. Or it could be by an association. He says, okay, this might be a useful substitute for an aristocracy in our current circumstances. And so kind of, this is just playing off of that. And as far as like diversity, there is differences. And I think the new left, once it got its equality and it's you know, it realized it didn't want it. Right? It's I forget who was I was reading somebody recently, and they were saying like everywhere the new left's understanding has triumphed, what we've ended up with is bureaucracy. Like, we did not end up with you know, equality and participatory democracy. You ended up with a bureaucracy. I mean, the universe, look no further than the universities. What happened is we just ended up with like a bloated administration, just kind of rules with an iron fist. It did not happen at all the way they said it was going to. And so Nisbet sees these associations. People will kind of self-separate, but in the sort of diversity of function and interest in a way that could be very, very healthy. It need not, you know. And if you look at some of the worst aspects of inequality, a lot of that's was state enforced. You know, was, the laws. You know, this is the kind of the it takes. You know, slavery. I mean, like this is the problem. Is a lot of people when they hear about inequality or something, they immediately go to kind of like the worst historical example. But you know, that had to be imposed, right? The common law didn't allow it. It had to be imposed, and it's that which meant there was state action to make it possible. So the no, sort of normal legal protections that just attach to persons as persons, that's the way they're defined in the common law, had to be like coercively stripped from a portion of the population in a way that it wasn't. It was a break from tradition, actually. And same, but something you could kind of tease this out in all sorts of ways. You know, the kind of infamous Supreme Court cases, they're dealing sometimes with laws, right? The state was enforcing it. So it wasn't even voluntary segregation. The state was going to go in and force it. So whatever other social realm problems were happening or oppressions or whatever, the state was involved kind of coercively in enforcing it. So Nisbet sees that as you know, it's through these voluntary associations that you actually can get around and through that stuff. And there are going to be differences in interest and occupation and talent, and you've got to kind of let them play out. This is the interesting thing about the natural aristocracy is our founders were not these egalitarians. You know, they recognized that there were some people that were uniquely talented to do certain things. Washington, for example, uniquely talented in all sorts of ways. I've often thought that the reason we've survived for 2.5 centuries without an aristocracy is because we did have one. We did have a monarchy. We had Washington. So he filled that imaginative role for us. And then we didn't need a real monarchy because we could, you know, this is kind of the funny thing is the American colonists celebrated the king's birthday. They were like, in their heart of hearts, we're monarchists. But then the king betrayed us. But that's okay, because we had Washington. So everyone starts celebrating Washington's birthday.
Right.
And we still do. So he fulfills this kind of monarchical aristocratic role that allows like that imaginative dimension to be filled there. And then we can kind of like govern ourselves through these Republican institutions. C.S. Lewis has this great line where he says, you know, the human imagination will not be denied. You'll either have kings and have aristocrats, or you will honor prostitutes. Like, you'll honor something. And very clearly we've gone the latter route, right? I mean, the kind of glowing profiles we see of some of the OnlyFans figures.
Yeah.
Or I just read one recently of this woman who she was in her early 40s, diagnosed with terminal cancer, left her husband and kind of went on like some sexual escapades. Hulu was going to do a series on her. Like, she's receiving honor like she's this great hero. I mean, and this is, we have this imaginative dimension. We have to look up to something. And so we don't provide an aristocracy that sets values and standards that are good for society. We follow somebody. Somebody's going to have, Hulu's going to make a series about somebody. So who's it going to be? We're going to have a leadership class of some sort. Is it going to be the prostitutes, literally, or is it going to be, well, the aristocratic figures in a traditional sense?
Well, and also when a lot of, especially in media and in like film, when they do, like, let's say they do a biopic of someone who isn't bad, right, who is someone we should look up to. I can't think of an example off the top of my head right now. They will deliberately emphasize everything dark about that person, right? That's the most interesting thing, the drugs they did, the affair they had, right? I'm not saying those things are good, but I'm saying that it's possible that in the last, 2,000 years, someone who did something dumb, Cicero's a good example here, right? You can still look up to him. Like, he's still better than the example, the OnlyFans person, right? I mean, this striking lack of people to look up to. I remember, when we lived in D.C., I can't remember I was applying for some job or some internship somewhere. And they're basically, there's like an ideological screening part of the application. You guys have probably seen something like this, where they're trying to see what kind of conservative you are or what kind of whatever you are. And it asks, what living politician political figure do you most admire? I don't remember who I put, but I know I had to make it up because I couldn't think of one. I could not think of one. And I think this is part of the problem, is that when we talk about elites and aristocrats, we're still going back to that issue we mentioned earlier, is that we immediately think of the oligarchs. And again, like Luke was just saying, the people that get the most attention, they're the ones that fuel that dopamine culture. I just wrote about that in our recent, the May newsletter for Ciceronian Society. That's what is fueling us, not this preoccupation with what's best, right? We're coming up toward the end of our time. I want to give each of you, if there's a last word you want to put in here, and I think this is, I could be wrong, but I think this episode is going to air in August, right before our call for papers is due on September 1st, 2025 for our 2026 conference. This is a subject where, not a lot of people are writing on it anymore, unfortunately. Where are some places that you all could take this next, right? In terms of what we're going to research and write about and talk about and explore and share. So who wants to go first on that question? Yeah, Ethan, go ahead, man.
Well, it's possible. Just as was the case with Volume 1, there were some reviews that were published, and Luke said, here are some more figures that you should look at. And I've already heard some interest from some people about a Volume 3. So that's a possibility. We'll see about that. But also, let me put in a plug for a podcast that's coming up a bit later on another figure who is discussed in the first volume, Konstantin Leontief. Okay, another person no one's ever heard of. And he has been called the Russian Nietzsche. So imagine a Russian who is like Nietzsche and then converts to Orthodox Christianity. And so you have an interesting mix of ideas there. So that's coming up. But as far as, these are some of the topics that we discuss at the Ciceronian Society. So one place where such discussions are welcome.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
I guess one thing, I guess two things I would say. One is that in a way, what I've been saying about Nietzsche is a return to that old question in Plato about the nature of philosophic rule. The human being lives within horizons for Nietzsche, and the philosopher is the one who establishes those horizons. But then secondly, I'm a little surprised that neither you nor Ethan had brought this guy up already. So forgive me for crass self-promotion. I think one of the natural places to go for this kind of inquiry is Philip Reeve, who is very concerned with the nature, function, status, purpose, source, and loss of authority in our society, both with a lowercase a and a capital A. So, for anyone who's very interested in this, I would suggest looking at the work of Philip Reeve as well, Reeff, for those who don't know.
Yeah, Ethan, go ahead.
Yeah, just thank you, Michael, for reminding me that I should have self-promoted as well, right? Because I'm in that volume as well. Yeah, so
But it's
Philip
called
Reeve,
they're aristocratic.
right? And my article was about what he has to say about elites and the relationship of elites to the rest of the population. So yes, so Philip Reeve, definitely. But also, I was only going to say that yeah, we're talking about elites and the aristocracy. This was a thread that I wanted to come back to, so I'll just say a couple words about it. Diversity, right? The society that aristocratic thinkers defended was a diverse society in that it was composed of different classes and different regions, and even those at on the bottom rung can be beautiful too, right? They have their own customs, their own way of life, and provided that they have that sort of community structure. Those are beautiful human beings as well, and a kind of order that aristocratic thinkers defended was that kind of order where you can where each in his place, each according to the customs of that particular order, has its forms, has its traditions, has its ways of relating to each other, and there's a kind of beauty in that as well.
Luke.
Yeah, and following up on a couple things here, I think, the defense of aristocracy is not just an offense of aristocracy; it's a defense of the other classes as well, as Ethan said. So, I mean, think about, the kind of glowing profile we get of the hobbits in Lord of the Rings. It's the hobbits are not aristocrats, but they're part of that society. They're not Aragorn, they're not Faramir, but there's a goodness there too, that's really worth preserving, and that society gets shredded too when the aristocracy goes down. One good, actually, Rick Avramenko some years ago, the co-editor in this volume, recommended Poldark, a show to me on Masterpiece Theatre some years ago, and it depicts this kind of petty aristocrat in England, and his relationship to kind of English society, and you get this good kind of snapshot of what an aristocracy can be. And it's not flawless. So he, on the one hand, he's the aristocrat. He lives in his ancestral house, which is pretty nice. He, of course, is pretty wealthy. And he oversees something like 100 peasants, right? And they live in shacks and stuff like that. But he really cares about them. I mean, he's always going to bat for them. He works alongside them in the mines, and works in the fields with them because he has to make sure that everything is done correctly. And he's, one of the worries when the mine goes dry is that what happens to them? Like, I mean, that's bad for him, but at least he has a nice piece of land and the house. What happens to these guys who work for him and their families? And he's worried about that. And he's also arrogant and stubborn. And it kind of juxtaposes him with the new money figure in the area. So the difference between the old aristocracy is they paid for the church, they paid for the priest, but they never, ever put pressure on the church to do anything. They would show up just like everybody else and sit there. But the new money guy comes in and starts paying for the church and paying for the priest, and he deliberately shows up to church late and makes them wait for him, so they can't start the service until the local aristocrat who pays for everything shows up. But that's the new money way of seeing it. Is I need my honor and glory. The old way, the aristocratic way, was no. I'm actually just this one role in the community, and I play my role well, but I don't impose on them. And I think, kind of for further study, I think there's probably a lot of aristocratic figures around that get ignored. And what I mean by that is major figures, say, in the 20th century in various founding of associations and that sort of thing. And as you kind of pointed out, if we're going to profile somebody, we're going to emphasize the darkest part of them. There were people who did really great things. And one reason they might not have been profiled is they didn't have an affair. I mean, what if they were faithful for 50 years? It's like, how fun is that? So no need to profile that guy. Just find the guy who had the affair, and then we can talk about it. And I think there's room to talk about the influential figures who played the aristocratic role, but haven't been given the credit they were due, because we don't have an aristocratic mind. We have to ignore that aspect.
Well, I think, you know, you bring up Lord of the Rings as well as Poldark is actually that'd be a great opportunity for a third volume, right? I mean, works of imagination have done so much to either destroy our view of aristocracy, right, to give us a vision of oligarchy, or to elevate others. I mean, I think of Downton Abbey is a great modern example of giving us a picture of what is this, what aristocracy is. We can critique it. It has all kinds of issues. I mean, in some ways, I don't know if you guys watched Downton Abbey, but it's kind of at war with itself, right? You can see in the show a fight between this old view that, you know, rule by the best would kind of be nice, but you know, looking, you know, what's the upstairs, downstairs type, you know, view. Poldark's a good example. Lord of the Rings is a great example in that respect. I've actually been reading, last year I read all of the Patrick O'Brien novels, the Master and Commander, all that. Those are really, really good. And then this year I'm reading through the Horatio Hornblower ones, which are also good. And I think they don't use the words, you know, aristocrat and peasant, really, but they're that. You know, works of imagination, whether it's film or literature, would be a great, great book, I think, thinking through aristocracy on this. So anyways, well, guys, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Thank you for your all that you do for the Ciceronian Society. Thank you. All right. You've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. And if you haven't heard yet, we'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th. Paper and panel proposals are due September 1, 2025, and we hope you'll consider joining us for what is always a great time. We especially welcome papers like the ones we're discussing today, the different topics, as well as topics related to the spirit of Russell Kirk's Roots of American Order, thinking through the long inheritance of examples, aristocratic or otherwise, and the thinking that informed what the American framers accomplished, especially given the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.